Around the Middle East in 45 minutes. As we go to the Middle East, you know, when you pick a topic like this, you got to be ready to change almost in mid-speech what you were going to do, because things happen so quickly. And fortunately, on my BlackBerry, I get some newsletters by email, or newspapers rather, the New York Times and a few others, and every morning I look at it, and you find things that happen that alter the course of your speech every single day. So we change directions a little bit, but you know, we talk about the Middle East, I ask myself questions about it. Bob, why don't you bring up the world there, the whole world? I ask myself, why is it called the Middle East? What's it east of, and what's it in the middle of? I mean, that's an interesting question. So, as it turns out, well, it's east of Europe. I mean, it's a Eurocentric term that comes from the British colonial period that east, the Near East was the Balkan area. If Bob would bring up the Middle East for us, you'll be able to see that. The Balkans up in here, the British call the Near East, the Middle East, and China and Japan, the Far East. And now it's a generic term that's like Coca-Cola or Kleenex or something like that. But as you can see, this area is the confluence of three continents that come together in this critical part of the world, Europe, Asia, and Africa. And an ancient and holy land, obviously, at least holy in some places. But the question for us today is, what is America doing there? And how does it affect us, affect our children, things like that? And as we look at it, we can journey across a couple of different areas. Of course, Tunisia right here is where the revolutions that are going on there began. Some young man decided that he had been persecuted, and so he poured gasoline on himself and set himself on fire and touched off a revolution that has spread completely around the Middle East now. The latest version happening up in Syria here, that's going on right now. Things are happening there virtually every day that we'll get to in a minute. But we can talk about Libya for a minute, because I know you're all familiar with the fact that the United States chose to lead a NATO attack on Libya and in support of the rebels, we'll call them that, seeking to overthrow Colonel Gaddafi, who's been in power there since 1969, one of the longest serving dictators in the history of the world, 42 years now, and a pretty tough individual, as it turns out. But in the Middle East, you talk about Islam and you talk about dictators, and it's a tribal area, and what that means is that these countries, to us, we look at them and we see their lines on the map, but to a lot of these tribal people who live there, they don't see the lines. They just see their ancient tribes. And what happens when a strong man, a dictator, if you will, comes in control of a country, he establishes a system where he basically says, if you will support me, then I will make sure that these minorities are kept safe. The one of the two Islamic denominations, the Shias and the Sunnis, one of them is going to be a minority, and when that dictator is gone, these people tend to rise up against what they consider to be the persecution that's happened over the years, and they start warring against each other and killing each other. Just look at what happened in Iraq when we invaded Iraq. The same thing, all the Christians have been killed off now, 500,000 of them. I'm told now that there's only about 10% of them left. You know, they're either dead or they're refugees in their own country. Many of them have gone up to Syria, where now they face the same thing with Assad under heat there. And today, this morning in the New York Times, I read that President Obama has cautiously imposed a few sanctions on Syria, not on Assad's personal wealth and so forth, but on Syria itself. He's stepping out little by little and saying, Mr. Assad, it's time for you to go. Well, the Assad family has run Syria now for more than 40 years. And when he leaves, this majority Sunni population, what will happen? Well, there's a good opportunity for them to finally get the revenge on the Shias and the Christians that they've always wanted. So we'll see what happens in that regard. But these two denominations, the Sunnis and the Shias, you hear that term a lot. And sometimes we don't know what it really means, but it's really a split that happened in the Islamic faith when Muhammad died in 632. Who would succeed him? And that's essentially what it's about. And you could think of it today, to put it in today's perspective, if you think about the sectarian violence that happened in Ireland, the Catholics and the Protestants, you always wonder about that. Why are these two supposedly Christian groups killing each other? Well, that's what people do, for one thing. They kill each other. But the Catholics always looked at the Protestants as invaders and persecutors. The same thing with the Shias and the Sunnis. 80 to 90% of the world Islamic population is Sunni. But some countries, Iran being the best example, 95% Shia. And it's kind of a pariah in many ways, but it's just waiting to see what happens in Syria, because Iran really needs Syria to keep pressure on Israel, their ancient enemy, and to give them influence in Lebanon, which essentially has no government at all now. It's run by Hezbollah primarily through Syria and Iran. Bob, why don't you bring up the next slide? Now, Saudi Arabia is another country that was once tribal, but in 1932, the British had a mandate from the League of Nations, which we signed off on, although we weren't members of the League. But the British simply selected a tribe, the Saudis, and Arabia became Saudi Arabia. In other words, tribal really means countries within countries. And everybody wants his tribe to be the country. And so now, this majority Sunni country has a very large Shia population, which lives mostly along this coast where their oil production is. Most of the oil that we know is in Saudi Arabia lies along this coast of the Persian Gulf, a very heavily populated by Shia region. And so the Saudi royal family is very nervous about that. And they know that Iran, right across the Persian Gulf from them, they don't want to see these Shias empowered like they're being empowered in Bahrain right now, because Bahrain is a majority Shia country, but it's run by a Sunni monarchy. An unusual situation, but that's why they invited the Saudis to come in and use the Saudi Arabian army to put down unrest when these protests started there. But here's a situation I want to point out to you, that Bahrain, this tiny little island right here, is connected to Arabia by a little causeway that's named after some Saudi king. And what's its significance to us today? Well, it's located on one of the world's greatest oil producing areas, right through here for one thing. The most important thing is it's the home port of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. And to me, when I look at it, that would be a big problem. I mean, that would make me very nervous, because this narrow passage here, the Strait of Hormuz, that goes down into the Gulf and into the Arabian Sea, you know, we hear constantly about how that the Iranians are threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz, which they could do apparently by sinking a super tanker or something in the Gulf. If I were an admiral or the commander in chief, that would make me very nervous if I had my fleet bottled up in the Persian Gulf through such a narrow passage. But I'm not an admiral, I'm not the commander in chief, so it doesn't seem to bother them, so I don't guess it should bother me either, except that there's a lot of American sailors sitting over there that one might be concerned about. Now, the Arabians are smart people. This is all their oil, but a lot of it is their pipelines run across to ports on the Red Sea over here, which is another narrow passageway that is populated on both sides by essentially terrorist states. In Yemen, here the dictator of Yemen, Mohammed Saleh, just agreed to step down and go the way of the Tunisian dictator, Ben Ali, and move and live out the rest of his life in palatial luxury in one of the Emirates. Not a bad deal. This is the deal that Gaddafi is apparently trying to work out for himself. He has no reason to leave unless he's given immunity from international prosecution, which so far, apparently, no country has come forward to say we will accept this man. Now, let's move north a little bit, Bob. Okay. Syria and this little narrow strip of land, Israel, something is happening there right now. Let's talk about Egypt down here for a minute. One of the most ancient lands in the Middle East, the civilization has been stable there for at least 4,000 years. But now, Egypt has been run by a military dictatorship since 1952. Three military officers have run Egypt for 59 years, I guess that is. In 1952, a man named Nasser and one of his lieutenants, Anwar Sadat, led a revolution in Egypt and gained control of the country. Nasser was president until 1970, when Anwar Sadat, Nasser died under some rather mysterious circumstances, and Anwar Sadat became president. He took the country in a slightly different direction, and he took it in an American direction. And you can remember, if you're old enough, the scenes where he and Jimmy Carter and Menachem Begin from Israel sat down and reasoned together at Camp David. They came up with a treaty to put an end to the constant wars between Egypt, Syria, and Israel. It's been rather stable since 1979 because of this peace treaty. But now, well, when Sadat was assassinated in 1981, and Mubarak took over Egypt, he kept that treaty in place, and he kept Egypt squarely in the American camp. But now, with Mubarak leaving, things are starting to change. The Israelis are apparently very nervous about that, as you would think. You have a slide of Israel there. Okay, look at this. This is Egypt. And this is Israel. And Israel is also a country that was formed rather by the British after World War I under the British mandate. They had a mandate that was known as the Balfour Declaration, and that was when Sir Arthur Balfour just made the statement, His Majesty's government would look with favor upon the creation of an ancestral home for the Jewish people in Palestine. And all these Jews started immigrating into Palestine, and by the start of World War II, 450,000 of them were there. Now 40% of all the Jews in the world live in Israel. But these two little areas, the Gaza Strip right here along the Mediterranean coast and the West Bank, well, you always ask yourself, the West Bank of what? The Jordan River and a little bit of the Dead Sea, where the Palestinians live. But Gaza, a constant problem. The Israelis have blockaded the Mediterranean coast, so supplies can't be brought into them. There are really only three ways in and out: the north, the middle, and this border with Egypt, which under the 1979 treaty has been kept closed all this time. Well, until today. Now the Egyptians are saying that they're going to open this border and let the Palestinians cross back and forth. These two groups that control the Gaza Strip, Hamas and Fatah, who have fought each other forever, now have kissed and made up. And if I were an Israeli, I'd be nervous about that. But also Egypt has reopened its diplomatic relations with Iran for some strange reason. And so these two people that the Israelis were so hoping they could keep in their camp seem to be drifting away. Egypt says that it tends to keep this treaty and not abrogate the treaty, but it wants to be brought more into the family of nations to get along with everybody. That's what the Egyptians say. And so they've recognized Iran, and they want to let these Palestinians out of their imprisonment in this little narrow strip of land so that they can get food and clean water and things like that. Israel has fought so many wars over the years, starting in 1948 when they declared their independence. The British really wanted a more of a relationship with the Arabs, where the oil was, and the Israelis, kind of sensing that weakness, started a resistance movement against the British. And the UN does what it does. It appointed a committee to study the problem, and this UN committee kind of redrew the lines, and really this West Bank territory and Gaza was a UN creation. But there it is today, and when the British left in 1948, just as we did in Vietnam in 1954 when the French left, we were more than happy to step in and take over their problems and inherit them, and we still have them today. What's our next slide, Bob? Yeah. These were French colonies at that time in North Africa. And in Libya, you can ask yourself why the United States or NATO would attack Libya. And so, who knows, I guess, is the answer. But there's one answer that we can know for certain. I thought about this and tried to reason my way through it as to why we would do that. And there, I can only come to one conclusion as to one reason it was done we can eliminate, and that is for humanitarian reasons. The reason for that is because that's the reason the government gave us for doing it. So we know absolutely, without any doubt, that that's a lie and not the reason. So if you think about Libya and Gaddafi, and you look at what he was doing prior to this attack, there's no work in Libya. There's nothing, no place for anybody to work. And the people live along a narrow band along the Mediterranean coast, 1,800 kilometers long. So all they have is oil, and they ship 1.8 million barrels of oil a day before this attack. Now they ship none. But Gaddafi used that oil to enact a social welfare system in his country. Now, I'm sure he kept some for himself, but he did provide a very generous social welfare system to his people, essentially saying, if you'll let me stay here and run this country, and you won't surround me with pitchforks and rocks and so forth and try to kill me, I'll give you a free place to live, free transportation, free gasoline, free food. Essentially, that's what he had done. And he liked to think of himself as a big player in Africa. And he tried to organize a Pan-African Union to unite all these countries into one. And he had this idea where he would enact an African country, currency rather, an African currency that was basically based on the gold standard, the gold dinar, and just have one gold-based currency. There basically were two countries that were involved in this, Libya and the Ivory Coast. By a strange coincidence, both those countries have been at war now for quite some time. The Ivory Coast, I mean, their dictator, Gbagbo, I think his name was, he was defeated in the election and just refused to leave, which is kind of a tribal tradition, you know, you lose and you stay. But his opponent fought a war to get him out of office, which he's finally done. The other thing that our friend Colonel Gaddafi did was he refused to join George Bush's Africa Com, which was a military-based system that Bush tried to put together for Africa, where each one of these countries would simply come under kind of an American military umbrella. And Gaddafi said no thanks to that. I mean, I don't know if any of that has anything to do with why we would start bombing in Libya, but if you think about it, supposedly for humanitarian reasons, Gaddafi was killing his own people, we say. So this is the question that you receive when you voice some opposition to the war. Well, people will say, so you're in favor of just sitting on the sideline and watching this dictator murder his own people. That's the option that you're giving, as if that's your only choice. Well, now if you think about that logically, in 24 hours, we sent $500 million worth of cruise missiles into Libya. And New York Times says the Gaddafi's forces use non-specific weapons. You know, this is a war crime, it says. Non-specific weapons. Well, by that they mean cluster bombs, which if you have any experience in the military, is a bomb that's dropped and it breaks open and all these little bomblets come out, like 100 of them. It's an anti-personnel type of thing. It's been a long time for me, but I think I still remember the maximum effective casualty radius of a 500-pound bomb is 100 meters. That's pretty non-specific, I can tell you that. You know, I don't think a 2,000-pound cruise missile is very specific either. But we sent more than 130 of them into Libya in 24 hours. This from a nation that's $14 trillion in debt. We just sent $500 million into there to kill these people. So it's kind of like that old saying that people used to say in Vietnam, you know, jokingly. It's not a joke, really, but it is kind of funny. You know, we're going to save you people if we have to kill every last one of you to do it. We're going to stop Gaddafi from killing his people by doing it for him, essentially. And now we're getting ready to do it in Syria. because John McCain and Joe Lieberman, just like they did in Libya. Libya, you could say, another thing you could say about it is it's the only war in American history that was not approved in advance by a single American office holder. If you think about that, it actually makes sense. But the president did not go to Congress or even consult them before he did it. And John McCain went over there and really chided the president because there are no American ground troops there fighting. This guy never met a war he didn't like. I mean, he's unbelievable. Now he's doing the same thing in Syria. He and Lieberman were up there saying, hey, we need to, people are killing each other over here and we're not a part of it. I mean, that's literally what he's saying. He's saying he's embarrassed. He's embarrassed by the president's lack of will and courage. But the president says that there are going to be no ground troops in Libya, no American ground troops in Libya. And so if that's true, why are elements of the 2nd Marine Division sitting on ships off the coast of Libya right now? Why are they there? I myself served in that division and actually spent some time there. I mean, but at the time I didn't know any better. I wonder what's going to happen. You know, when I say that I'm anti-war, I'm actually quite proud of that. I make no apologies for it because war is not what it seems to be. It's really just brutality, and it doesn't help anything. It only makes things worse. That's my opinion. So why is the United States so willing to fight? Who knows, you know, but it's like it's our first thought. You know, our people seem to like war. I debate these things all the time with people. And the one thing I'm criticized for the most is being anti-war. Even the gentleman who spoke to us the other night, who did such a good job about fundraising, alluded to anti-war. The other day I got a comment to something I'd written about it. This gentleman said, in reference to me, you liberals are all alike. Because I had expressed some disapproval with our willingness to go abroad looking for people to kill. There are so many problems in America. I had a gentleman one time who I had written a statement. He wrote me, and he's given me some publicity. He got a couple of my things published on WorldNet Daily for me, but he had asked me about what, in my opinion, America should do in the Near East, as he called it, meaning Afghanistan and Pakistan and so forth. And I said, come home and mind our own business. And he wrote me back and said, write an article for me defining what you mean by mind our own business. And I said, well, what can I say? Mind your own business. Come home and solve America's problems, which are many, many, many unsolved. By the way, in Pakistan now, to show you how confusing things are and how illogical, where America, launches a drone attack. You know, after that attack in Arizona, where this congresswoman was shot and the judge that the gentleman talked about last night was killed, and many other people, I think 9 people, I think, finally, by some lunatic. The next day in the newspaper, it said 27 people killed in drone attack in Pakistan. You know, I don't know if you ever thought about this, but those people are people too. They have kids just like we do. And we say we're pro-life. We talk about that, but Are we really pro-life? Don't their lives mean anything? Or is it just lives inside their mother's bodies that we're concerned about? But the illogical thing I was talking about is I just read a couple of days ago where Pakistan is going to start buying this newest scary-looking jet fighter from China, the F-3 that everybody seems so concerned about. They're going to buy that from China. Why? I mean, don't they have plenty of ours? You wonder. I mean, what it all means and what it's all about. It's almost too crazy to imagine. But there's something really strange going on out there in this Middle Eastern world. But look at this. If what are the last two countries in the Mediterranean that aren't at least dominated in some fashion by the United States military? Well, I'd say Libya and perhaps Syria. And both those countries are essentially under attack right now. So sooner or later, you know, U.S. military will control all this. I mean, Libya sends the majority of its oil to Europe. 25% of Italy's oil comes from Libya, or it used to, and 10% to France and other countries. But that's not 10% of Libya's production. It's 10% of their total oil imports. Another country that's drastically affected by this, Japan, imports 100% of its oil and 100% of its coal. The only way Japan had to power its economy without oil and coal is nuclear. And that country has a very interesting history with nuclear power. But right now, Japan has got to be very, very nervous about what's going on in the Persian Gulf and other places, because virtually all of its oil passes through that narrow choke point. So this is a terrible time for them, a difficult time. And I'm not one of those people who says their economy is going to bounce back in no time. Perhaps it will, but it won't be no time. That's my opinion. This is the Middle East. And if you think about it, to answer that question that I asked in the beginning, where people would say to me, well, so you would just sit by and watch Gaddafi murder his own people, you wouldn't do anything about it? Those are your choices. Either let the dictator murder his own people. You know, you have to answer a question. Either you're basically an uncaring, unfeeling person who would permit these murders to happen, or you are in favor of the war, one of the two. Well, this question was asked more than 2,000 years ago, a similar question, to another man who came into the Middle East at that time. You know, when Jesus, he was a threat to the ruling elite as well. He was a threat to the Roman authorities, and he was a threat to the religious authorities. But the religious authorities in particular hated him. And so they came out to greet him one day, and they said, "Teacher, should we pay this tax or not?" And this was a hated tax. It was a religious issue with the Jews. To pay this tax to the Romans really, really ground on them, because it was a violation of their religious principles, this head tax. And so they say, would you pay the tax? I mean, if he said no, then he's defying Roman authority. But if he says yes, then he's no friend of the people, because he's telling them to pay this horrible tax. So he says, bring me a denarius. And I mean, you know the story. He asked them, whose image and whose inscription is on this coin? And they said, Caesar's. And he said, so render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and unto God the things that are God's. Well, this is the issue then. Whose image is on us? Caesar's or God's? That's the issue. The Bible says that we're created in God's image. Some people don't believe that, but I do. So it's his image. that's on my life, not Caesar's. I owe no homage to the state. I mean, I do owe the state a certain degree of loyalty. That's why we pledge allegiance to the flag, but we don't worship it. That's reserved for God, so we should feel no compunction about criticizing government action when it's necessary to do so. And it's necessary right now because, think about this, basically, we're bankrupt. It's only a matter of time until this whole economy collapses, unless something changes somewhere down the line. If there were no Federal Reserve, then none of this would be possible because somebody would actually have to pay for it with real money. I mean, that's not a joke, it's true. But there is a Federal Reserve. So I've still got 10 minutes left, Jim. I saw you looking at me. But here's the point I'm trying to make. And asking what we're doing in the Middle East, think about these two things. The National Endowment for Democracy has an annual budget of $100 million. And it pours money into these Middle Eastern countries to support anti-dictator propaganda, I guess you could say, or information, if you don't like that word. But it's also used to fund all of these social websites that these protest movements, revolutionary movements, can use to communicate with each other. And it's a way of doing it so that they can't be tracked by their governments. This is all taught to them and given to them through the National Endowment for Democracy. And still, we hypocritically set aside and say, we have nothing to do with this. We have nothing to do with these movements. And we love Assad. We don't want him to be overthrown. But at the same time, we're broadcasting millions and millions of dollars into his country in anti-Assad type information. It's really weird, but I'll tell you something that's even weirder. In Libya, this is where it gets really weird. In Libya, you know, this is so weird, I have to get some water. You know that when we decided to do this thing in Libya, the president, by executive order, froze all Libyan assets in the United States, and he made it a crime to do business with Libyan companies. Crime. But at the same time, the Federal Reserve was giving $26 billion to the Arab Banking Corporation, a Bahrain-based company that is 59% owned by the Central Bank of Libya, a 100% owned Libyan bank. So in essence, we just gave $26 billion to the Libyan government. At the same time, we had put these sanctions on them, and at the same time, we have them under attack. And this banking corporation has branches in the United States, which were exempt, specifically exempted, from the president's ban on doing business with them. So they're still doing business, and they're still receiving money from the Federal Reserve right now. You figure that one out. But here's something else about it. What do they do with that $26 billion, and what's the collateral? See, this money has got to be paid back to the Federal Reserve because bankers don't do anything unless they get their interest. I mean, they're going to be repaid one way or the other. Well, what's the collateral for this $26 billion loan, which was at 0.25% interest, or 0.25% interest? Well, the collateral is U.S. Treasury notes, which we have to pay back. U.S. Treasury notes were used as collateral for this loan. Now, how does that work? Well, it works like this. You give them the $26 billion, you being the taxpayers, because you're obligated to pay it back once the Federal Reserve creates it on their computers. they used the $26 billion to buy federal debt, our debt that we owe. And we pay them interest on the money. This is how it works. I mean, that's the scam. Why we do it, who knows? I don't know, but we're doing it. So at the same time we're bombing and killing these people, we're giving them $26 billion, guaranteeing it with our tax money, then paying them interest on the money as they pay it back. That is another interesting part about the Middle East right now. This is part of the hypocrisy under which we live. You know, you wonder, I always return, I don't want to seem one-sided when I talk about what the current president's doing, so I always have to say that I'm opposed to war crimes, so when people commit them, whether he's a Democrat or Republican, I accuse him of war crimes. The president, the former president, he confessed to it in his book. He bragged about it, said he was proud of it. Yeah, I tortured people, he said. I'd do it again. That's what he said in his book. The same crimes that we hanged Germans and Japanese for, he confessed to. That seems hypocritical, at least to me. But anyway, I'm almost finished. This is the Middle East as we have it today. Right now, Egypt and the Palestinians are reaching accord, and the Palestinians, that gate in Gaza is going to be open. It's not open yet, but soon. And who knows what's going to happen to Assad in Syria. I mean, he's obviously a brutal dictator. He's killed like 400 people in these protests, which I don't mean to make light of that, but when you really think about the totality of things, I mean, how many people die in a B-52 raid? A lot, I would imagine, but who knows? I mean, as they say, you know, when you kill one person, it can seem horrible. It's a murder. But when you kill thousands, it's honorable. That's what generals do. So, right on time, I come to the end of my presentation. Let me just close by saying that I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. Every time I do it, I wonder if it's the last time. Who knows? You know, this might be my swan song. So if it is, I really appreciate this chance and all the chances that you've given me over the years. Thank you very much.